Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Menlo Park Dental Excellence, providing general dentistry with quality care to all patients, serving patients one at a time with no triple booking, flexible hours Monday through Saturdays, mpdentalexcellence.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, political trouble involving San Diego's mayor. Why the city has such a long string of scandals. Plus, a plan to reverse eroding beaches. Not everyone on the coast is on board.
I'm not opposed to putting sand on the beach. My opposition relates to how much sand they're talking about digging up offshore.
Also, he's the most notorious inmate in California. Charles Manson aspired to be a rock singer, and the author of a new biography describes how Manson's desire for stardom led to seven murders.
He had these followers. He wanted to be a rock and roll star. He also wanted to be a preacher talking about an apocalyptic race war called Helter Skelter. And unfortunately, in August of 1969, the threads came together and people died.
It's the California Report.
Feel the sand between my toes.
You know when everything just flows?
Happiness is calling me.
San Diego feels just like that.
San Diego is known for its beaches and sunny weather, but these days, a large shadow is being cast over the city by its mayor, Bob Filner. At least 16 women say Filner made inappropriate and unwanted sexual advances toward them over the past few years, plunging his office into crisis just 7 months into his term.
I apologize to my staff. I apologize to the people of San Diego. And most of all, I apologize to the women that I have offended.
Filner has been out of sight since making that statement last month. He took 2 weeks off for behavioral therapy, treatment he said wrapped up a week early. His office referred questions to his attorney, who didn't return calls. But the city council is unanimously calling for Filner to resign. The locks have been changed on the mayor's office to protect potential evidence, and this weekend a campaign to recall the mayor begins collecting signatures. This is hardly the first political scandal to envelop San Diego, only the latest. I traveled there this week to hear how this one is playing out. The Knob Hill Restaurant is a fixture in San Diego, a local favorite since opening in 1944.
Filner's offense is very personal. It has really nothing to do with the politics of San Diego.
Mary Dell Evans is eating breakfast with her husband. She says it's time for Filner to go.
I think we're a laughingstock, but so is Anthony Weiner in New York. He's a laughingstock. I mean, I think here today, gone tomorrow. If he got out, nobody would pay attention to it.
But if Filner resigns or is recalled, he'll be the third of the city's last six elected mayors to leave office amidst controversy. In the 1980s, Mayor Roger Hedgecock left over allegations of misusing campaign funds, and 8 years ago, Mayor Dick Murphy stepped aside during a fiscal meltdown surrounding the city's employee pension funds.
A good leader needs to know when it's time to move on, and I believe it's time for me to move on and time to bring a fresh start to our city.
During that episode, San Diego earned the nickname Enron by the Sea, a reference to the Houston Energy Company that went bankrupt after years of accounting fraud. UC San Diego political science professor Steve Erie wrote about it in a book called Paradise Plundered. Sitting by the waterfront near the USS Midway naval aircraft carrier, Erie describes what he sees as the root cause of repeated civic scandals.
The problem is that San Diego, as an old Navy town, developed an authoritarian command and control political culture. Father knows best. Dissent has been a punishable offense in San Diego.
And where are the watchdogs? Whether it's an institution, the city attorney, whoever it is that's supposed to be minding the store.
Well, San Diego is actually much better known for its lapdogs than its watchdogs.
Erie believes part of the problem is that most San Diegans don't really care much about politics.
There's a very low level of political interest, involvement, and participation in local governance in San Diego. Much less so than the Bay Area, and even less so than Los Angeles.
Bob Filner's predecessor in City Hall was Jerry Sanders, a Republican and former city police chief. Sanders inherited the city during its fiscal crisis and helped steady the ship. Today, he heads the regional Chamber of Commerce. Sanders calls the latest slide into civic controversy a tragic setback for San Diego.
We worked for 7 years, and I'm talking about everybody in the city, Democrats, Republicans, labor, business, to get out from under the title Enron by the Sea. And then just in 6 months, we're back under a cloud of ridicule.
At a playground in San Diego's Balboa Park this week, many people seem to take the current city scandal in stride. Carlinda Olson is here with her 3 young children. She says the sexual harassment allegations against Mayor Filner don't surprise her, but they do make her angry.
I was talking with my neighbors. I'm like, San Diego's such a great place to live in, to visit, and it's unfortunate that it might cast, you know, a shadow on San Diego. It's really not representative of San Diego. It's representative of politics.
Another young parent here, John Aldis, admits to voting for Filner because he liked his progressive agenda. More money for neighborhoods, better city services for families and kids, and stronger ties with Mexico.
I suppose I feel some buyer's remorse. And perhaps next time I'll pay more attention to, you know, whispers about people's, sort of past personal foibles.
Filner is only the second Democrat to win the mayor's office here since the mid-1980s, and the first liberal ever. In a sign of San Diego's continuing move to the political left, the city council now has a majority of Democrats. Council President Todd Gloria, a third-generation San Diegan and the openly gay son of a hotel maid and a gardener, would take over the mayor's office if Filner resigns.
I mean, he has no moral leadership at this point in time. The council unanimously does not support him any longer. The business community, the neighborhoods all want this man to leave. And so initiatives that may have great worth or great value cannot be led by him.
Gloria says Filner only won because he was the least bad choice between two political extremes on the left and right. But Mesa College political science professor Carl Luna says that's a reflection of San Diego's problems. Even as local Democrats have gained power, the party has been slow to generate new leaders, as shown by last year's weak field of mayoral candidates.
So it's time to step up the game. Don't invest just in one candidate like a Bob Filner. Develop your bench. And in the next 2 or 3 election cycles, I think you'll see a much more robust Democratic presence.
Luna says for too long, San Diego has been ruled by an old boys club, with secret pay-to-play deals benefiting downtown interests. He hopes the outcome of this will be a more transparent and open city government.
At the end of the day, San Diego will recover from this one like our other scandals. I think it is a growing pains of a city realizing that it is an international world-class city and it's no longer just a quiet little Navy retirement town.
There are now local, state, and federal investigations into different aspects of Mayor Filner's activities. San Diego's city attorney says he hopes a deal can be worked out soon for Filner's exit so the city can begin repairing the damage from its latest political drama. Faith in Bob Filner isn't the only thing eroding in San Diego. Beaches along the coast are literally being washed away. Some homeowners have built seawalls, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is working on an ambitious sand replenishment project. Allison St. John of KPBS says San Diego communities are key players in the debate over how to deal with eroding shorelines and rising sea levels.
Down at Moonlight Beach in Encinitas, Charlie Marvin reminisces how it was when he first came to live on the bluffs above the beach in North San Diego County.
When I first got here in the early 70s, there was a tremendous amount of sand. We used to have sand out in front of our home, basically from about May until October, flat, heavy sand.
But over the years, things have changed. Beaches in North County have been getting narrower and stonier.
If you don't replenish it, we will not have beaches.
A few miles south at Fletcher Cove in Solana Beach, city manager David Ott explains why beaches are shrinking.
That's because of dams up our rivers, jetties on our oceans, parking lots that cover all the sand flow into them. So there's really not a natural resupply of sand. So as the waves crash in, they take the sand out and eventually take all the sand out.
Ott says the city of Solana Beach has almost 2 miles of 80-foot bluffs, mostly made of rapidly eroding sandstone. He says boulders the size of Volkswagens have rolled onto the sand below with no warning. Private homeowners who could afford it have spent millions building seawalls to protect their properties. But the city of Solana Beach has recently updated its coastal land use plan and set new limits on seawalls.
In the approved plan, the permit may be issued for 20 years and then be reevaluated for any changed conditions after those 20 years.
The California Coastal Commission insisted on the 20-year time limit, drawing protests and threats of lawsuits from private property owners. Ultimately, the commission would like to see moving property back from the cliffs, a strategy called managed retreat. But that idea is not going over well in some of San Diego County's coastal communities.
This is a plan to basically try to prevent people from having seawalls after a certain amount of time and to deploy this idea of managed retreat, which hasn't really gone through the democratic process.
That's John Kahn, an attorney in Encinitas. He won a suit against the Coastal Commission on behalf of a private property owner who wanted to replace a collapsed seawall and stairs. The days of shoring up the cliffs with seawalls may be numbered, in which case Plan B is sand replenishment. The Army Corps of Engineers will complete a study later this summer on a plan to replenish beaches in Solana Beach and Encinitas over the next 5 decades. It would start by spreading 7 times more sand than in recent replenishment projects and keep topping it up every few years. Encinitas marine biologist Dennis Lees has his doubts about how dredging this much sand from the seafloor will affect marine life.
I'm not opposed to putting sand on the beach. My opposition relates to how much sand they're talking about digging up offshore.
Lees says the dredging will create trenches up to 20 feet deep just offshore. Sorting through the shells he's found in the sand, dredged up in recent sand replenishment projects, Lees says he's found plenty of evidence that decades-old shellfish were scooped up, animals that he says are an important part of the fishery's food chain.
So this guy was alive. You see how shiny he is inside, and he's got the periostracum? He was alive.
Despite some concerns, approval of the sand replenishment project may be fast-tracked. Solana Beach City Manager David Ott hopes the Army Corps and the Coastal Commission sign off on it.
There's probably no better poster child for a sand replenishment project in California than here in Solana Beach. And if we can't be successful here, it probably causes challenges for the rest of the state that may need some projects as well.
Even if the sand replenishment project is approved, it will be costly, Ott says, some $70 million over 50 years. There's an urgent reason to do the work. Researchers say sea levels could rise along Southern California's shores as much as 2 feet by 2050. Yet there's no telling whether shrinking government budgets and a rising sea level will make preserving the beaches and bluffs an increasingly difficult proposition. For the California Report, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
Well, any list of California's most notorious criminals would surely include Charles Manson. He and his cult followers were convicted of orchestrating the Tate-LaBianca murders, which took place in Los Angeles in 1969. The most famous victim was Sharon Tate, the pregnant wife of Hollywood director Roman Polanski. But more than 40 years later, it is Manson whose name is best remembered. In his new book titled Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, writer Jeff Gwynn follows Manson's tracks through Berkeley and San Francisco down to Los Angeles, describing how his obsession with the Beatles and landing his own recording contract led to the notorious murders that shook Hollywood more than 40 years ago. And Jeff Gwynn joins me now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Charles Manson was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, 1934. What kind of a childhood and home life did he have?
Part of the Manson mystique has always been that he was a child of the streets, the illegitimate son of a teenage prostitute who tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer. None of that really is true. His mother did serve a short prison sentence for a botched armed robbery, but he lived with relatives comfortably in West Virginia in a small town. And by the time he got here to San Francisco, he had a long record of violent juvenile delinquency. Then as an adult, everything from car theft to being a very unsuccessful pimp in Los Angeles.
And as you say, he gets here after getting paroled from prison in Los Angeles, arrives in San Francisco in just before the summer of love, 1967. And while he was in prison, you write that among the things that influenced him were Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and then also Scientology.
He was entranced by the Dale Carnegie course he got to take in prison because he thought it would make him a better pimp. He could get more women to cooperate. He liked Scientology because he was fascinated with how they could talk to people and try to recruit them. But then he heard the Beatles, and he knew what his dream was. He was going to be a bigger star than they were. When he was released from prison, Terminal Island, down in Los Angeles, came up to Berkeley because he knew somebody here. But the summer of love, Haight-Ashbury, it was just too much for him. He was looking for gullible followers, and where better could you find him?
He goes down to Los Angeles in a converted school bus.
Yep.
That was painted rainbow colors and black and had Hollywood Productions written on the side of it. And he wanted to get a music contract. And in fact, he became friendly with some of the Beach Boys.
Dennis Wilson, specifically. The other Beach Boys loathed Manson. Manson glommed onto Dennis Wilson, gave him all the girls and drugs that Dennis wanted, which was a considerable amount. And Dennis, who was a very friendly, helpful guy, did what he could to get Manson signed to the Beach Boys Brothers label, but the other Beach Boys wanted no part of him. But Manson also befriended other famous stars, Neil Young, John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas. He had plenty of chances to audition his music for some of the great talents, and none of them found him anything more than mediocre.
The night of those first murders in Hollywood, the Sharon Tate murders, he wasn't there. He didn't really kill anybody, but he orchestrated it and he ordered it. And as you point out, he manipulated everyone into thinking it was their idea and made sure that they all had, so to speak, blood on their hands, that they participated.
Very much so. That's the way Manson always controlled his followers, by using the Carnegie precept, let the other fellow think that the idea is his. The reason they picked that house was not because they intended to kill Sharon Tate specifically or Terry Melcher, the record producer who lived there before her. It was simply because Tex Watson, who was driving the car, knew how to get there from Spahn Ranch because he and Manson had driven there once or twice previously. We now know that after the murders were committed, Manson himself went back to the house because he didn't think they'd made the scene sufficiently shocking enough and move some things around, stage manage it, so to speak.
I think there's a popular perception that Charles Manson is crazy. And in fact, he used to play something of something he called the insane game
right,
from the time he was very young. Describe that. What was it, and how did it develop as he got older?
Charles Manson is a very small, slight man. As a full-grown adult, he was only 5'4". When his mother, not because she didn't want him, but because he was so violent and incorrigible, put him in the first of a series of boys' homes, he'd act worse and worse until finally he ended up in some really bad facilities where he would be preyed on as a small boy. That was when he told people he started playing the insane game, acting so crazy, like such a lunatic, that the bad kids would leave him alone. And I think the most telling story was told to me by both Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, that just before the final arrest in Mojave, Manson called the family around him and said, if I'm ever arrested again, I'm going to play Crazy Charlie. I'll do it as long as it takes till they decide I'm insane and let me go. And Krenwinkel, Van Houten, those who know him since, say he's been doing that since 1969.
The book is called Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson. Writer Jeff Gwynn, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt of Jeff Gwynn's book at californiareport.org. A About 100 kids from Fresno County earned free motocross bikes this week after completing a BMX summer camp with pro racer and Central Valley native Tony Hoffman. Hoffman teaches more than riding bikes on rough terrain. He also preaches character development and staying off drugs. And as reporter Alice Daniel explains, the lessons come right from Hoffman's past.
Riders ready. Watch the gate.
Nice and easy, guys.
Kids on BMX bikes speed around a dirt track, racing along rolling hills and veering up steep embankments. They're at a park in Fresno learning how to ride motocross style. The sport teaches discipline, self-confidence, says BMX pro Tony Hoffman, traits that might keep kids from doing drugs like painkillers, a big problem in the Central Valley.
You've got to stay away from these key things if you want to be successful in life, if you want to avoid the wreckage of my past.
For 5 years, Hoffman was addicted to OxyContin, then heroin. He doesn't want others to make the same choices, so he started a nonprofit 2 years ago called the Free Wheel Project. He gives anti-drug talks at high schools all over the Central Valley, and he says his camp provides at-risk youngsters like 15-year-old Angelica Haskin with a positive physical outlet. Haskin says she smoked weed for several years, even tried meth, and thought about killing herself.
It's kind of like a Band-Aid, like I can just smoke weed and be high and kind of just like be in that state where I didn't have to worry about anything.
She's been clean for 4 months and says the camp is an opportunity to improve her life.
When my week may not be going well, on Monday I always get to look forward to coming here and just hanging out.
Hoffman's high school years were vastly different. He was a nationally ranked BMXer. He had endorsements from Spy sunglasses, Airwalk shoes. He was great with computers. When he graduated, he got a tech job in San Diego and stopped racing. He started partying and gave in to peer pressure to try marijuana. That quickly led to other drugs.
Never knew that 4 years later I would be sleeping on the street, sticking needles in my arms, living in hotels.
Tony has been hospitalized numerous times. Once he almost lost his arm. Once he was stabbed, and he had a lung collapse from a drug deal that's gone bad. And I can't imagine how a parent can survive such a thing. And my husband and I are in our darkest moments and the weakest points. We would just lay in bed and hold hands each night and weep quietly for our child in the street.
Karen Hoffman, Tony's mother, is one of 30 volunteers at the camp. She says she's proud to help co-run her son's nonprofit.
If we look at today of where he's come, Tony's a miracle.
Her son's drug addiction was devastating, she says, something she couldn't stop. One Christmas when he was on the streets, he called and asked to see her. It took her a minute to recognize the homeless man with a shopping cart staring into her car window.
I asked him, I said, "What's in the cart, son?" And he said, "Mother, I may be hooked on heroin, I may be living in the streets, but I'm not stupid, I still have my computer."
Hoffman went from the streets to prison in 2007 for armed robbery. He says he was so desperate for a fix, he held a gun to a woman who had OxyContin in her home. But prison turned out to be a lifesaver.
Walking the streets alone with a drug addiction waiting to die is the most torment you'll ever experience in your life. Not prison. Prison was the first step to the top for me.
Inmates were doing heroin all around him, he says, but he got clean. He had a newfound faith in Christianity and an unlikely goal, to train hard in prison and return to BMX as an elite pro.
For me, coming back to BMX was kind of redemption from my past.
And an amazing feat, say other pro athletes who didn't think Hoffman had a chance.
So I reached the Olympic level. I made main events with Olympians. I just had to say, you know what? I think it's time for me to set it aside and start helping kids.
Tony.
Yep.
Where's Austin?
Where's Austin?
Yeah.
He's over there. See him?
Yeah.
Okay. He's over there. He'll be over, okay?
And that's what he's doing. At the camp, he tells the older kids, drugs will kill you or haunt you for the rest of your life. He even quizzes them to make sure they are listening.
Which family of drugs do prescription painkillers belong to? Everybody should have got this one. Opiates.
Hoffman says about 65% of the camp kids who are 12 and older admit to trying marijuana.
These kids are able to connect with me. They understand that I'm not here to be the police, and I let them know that. You know, I just want to know where these kids are at. What are we dealing with, you know?
Tony Hoffman is now fundraising for his next project to intensively train and tutor a small group of at-risk students interested in competitive BMX racing. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
Songwriter Eleni Mandel lives in Los Angeles, where she works to balance single motherhood with her music career. For our series California Songs, reporter Colin Berry talked to Mandel about her song The Future. She says it was inspired by a drive up north after a romance went south.
I was on my way to Seattle, and I have kind of a rule. I like to avoid driving on Highway 5 as much as possible because I've taken that road so many times.
I want to fall in love again. I know where it will happen. Along the California coast, where the ocean meets the mountains.
And decided to take the 101. And it's just beautiful. The rolling hills and Petaluma and all these charming towns.
Driving north, a winding road. I had a premonition. A golden beige and rolling hills. Leaving Point Reyes Station.
The premonition I'm talking about is that I'm going to fall in love again in it. But more generally, the premonition is that everything's going to be okay, which is kind of funny. I like to say that I'm a psychic for pointless things. I like to sort of get ideas for songs while I'm on the road, but I don't write while I'm on the road. I sort of take mental notes.
So
I really love performing these songs in a totally different space. Like when I am singing a song about a particular ex-boyfriend, I feel like it's a way of staying in touch with that person that's sort of, I don't know, in the universe. I'm not hippy-dippy at all. But I do feel like I connect with them again while I'm singing the song in a good way, even if the song is sad.
I can see.
I always worry about being too corny or being too vulnerable or honest. And I guess that's why I feel like it's a heart on your sleeve song, because there are these moments for me that feel very vulnerable even when I sing them now.
That's Eleni Mandel talking about her song, The Future. You'll find it on her 2012 album, I Can See the Future. To hear more of our California Songs series, go to californiareport.org. And that's the California Report for today, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. The engineer is Howard Gelman, with additional engineering from Jim Bennett and Rob Spate. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White and David Marks. Our interns are Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus. The editorial team includes Victoria Malleon, Susie Rocho, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.